Hi everyone, my name's Mick and I am an alcoholic. In this fellowship I am known as Mick the Ferret. Welcome to the third annual Downtown Reading Old Timers Weekender. This group wishes no negative atmosphere. Please respect this. Phones on silent, no sweets, no texting and no electronic cigarettes. Anybody that wants to smoke, outside these doors there's some plastic bins for the dog ends. Fire exits are both ends, and toilets are at that far door on the right, just behind the bushes. The preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisations or institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses or opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. In support of AA's singleness of purpose, attendance at closed meetings is limited to persons who have got a desire to stop drinking. I don't think I should read this.
I'm going to say to my wife, you're going to have to leave.
No. No, we don't need that bit.
Stay there.
Right, because this is an open meeting, because we want guests and Al-Anons, of course. Right. The next 2 days are happening due to a lady, non-alcoholic, whose passion and courage not to quit because it was raining. She taught us to dance in the rain. Sylvia came to our first old-timers event, believing that the pain that she was in, she would not stay too long. We had to chase Sylvia out at the end of the day, and the same again last year. Sylvia is with us today. Sat among us with Maura and the rest, sadly in spirit, the love that never dies. Sylvia was an Al-Anon member, and she came to this convention, and on the last convention, they were thinking that because we weren't getting many people coming, that they were thinking about not doing it again. And she's turned around and said that she thought this was a wonderful idea and it should be kept going. And, and she was an Al-Anon black belt and she loved AA and Alateen. If the chairs are empty or not, that is. Oh, yeah. If the chairs are empty, that is not what matters. It is our hearts filled with love and hope, whether it is Al-Anon or AA. I'm going to say 26 names of old-timers no longer with us. Tommy G, Walter, Jesse, Jimmy A, Ron G, MS John, SAS Angry John, Babs, Kevin Michael, Fireman Colin, Tall Mark, Taxi Gary, Wee Adam, Martin the Monk, Lockkeeper Joe, Young Maidenhead Mark, American John, Vera from Newbury, Melvin, Sheila from Bracknell, Eve of Henley, Barry of Wantage, Pat of Twyford, Guardsman John, and Irish Archie, and Maura. These are just a few names. So many more are not mentioned. It is good to say that their message still alive and living in the meeting they started decades ago that carries the message to the still suffering alcoholic. This is AA today. Sitting in an old tin hut, the urn is on, chatter in the kitchen, smoking no longer creating smoke-filled room, thankfully. Smokers outside. Others sitting, waiting for the meeting to start on time. Bill Wilson wrote in the AA Comes of Age, page 220, AA's claim, any alcoholic who continuously works the program, AA program has a better than a 3-in-1 chance of staying sober for their lifetime. Our old-timers are living proof at Bill's testament, which is being recorded. Copies will be available at the minimum cost and will be given to speakers. The cost of the event has been covered by members of Friday and Saturday Watlington House AA meeting. Bear this in mind that Tradition 7 enfold your change in the pot. Our old timers committee is a very young in AA. Thomas, 4 years. James, 3 years. David, 4 years. Neil, 20 months. Big Tom, 6 years. Refreshments will be in the refectory behind us in the main building. Right. I would like to introduce our first old timer. It's John J from Colney Monday night, who has kindly joined us to kick off today's proceeding. John, would you like to start?
My name is John Jones. I'm a recovered alcoholic in AA. I've just seen Jim walk in. Jim and I usually meet in Costa Coffee in Ampthill up in Bedfordshire. Lovely surprise to see him. We usually sit and have a chat. I've just met Mike. I haven't seen Mike for over 20 years, certainly over 20 years. And I just mentioned a young lady that he used to go around with. And it's funny what we remember. And I'd forgotten all about that until, that's Mike. It's just great to see people I haven't seen for such a long time. Funny enough, when you were reading the closed meeting format, Sue and I were in Key West, and we're having lunch, and the waiter at some point said, "Oh, I like your ring. I wear a circle and a triangle ring." I said, "Yeah, it's Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "Oh, that's fantastic." He said, "I know it is. I'm 9 months sober." I said, "Well, congratulations, but you're just the person I need to see. Can you tell me where the AA meetings are?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, you go down the road there, turn left. The AA clubhouse is down there, and I'll give you a list of all the venues." So we had lunch, and off we potted, and we found a meeting in a church that evening at 7:30. And we got into the meeting. It's packed. Well, up between 150 and 200 people in a massive meeting. And they read the closed meeting format. And I said to the lady sitting there, "Oh, no, they go around the room there for anyone from out of town or out of the country." And I identified myself, and they're about to move on. I said, "Before we move on, my wife's here. She's not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's a member of Al-Anon. Would you like us to leave?" And the secretary said, "No, you can stay, but that would be a hell of a long way to come to get kicked out of an AA meeting, wouldn't it?" You know, generally speaking, we find people so friendly and so accommodating in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we say there are no lectures to be endured. Well, that isn't true, because I've given a few of those over the years. My sobriety date is January the 17th, 1986. And you know, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was absolutely wonderful for me. Prior to getting here, I thought I was going mad. I thought I was going to start raving mad. I thought at some point I'd have to be locked up in a lunatic asylum. I know nowadays they call them treatment centres and psychiatric units, but in the old days we used to have these really austere buildings, these awful things. There's one at Shenley near St Albans. And they used to look dreadful. And I thought at some point I would have to be locked up in a lunatic asylum. And I imagined, you know, always being grand, that I'd be in a padded cell in a straitjacket. Now, if I put that into perspective, every morning, we lived in a really nice house, you know, fitted carpets, pedigree pussycats, potted plants from around the world. And I was off to do a day's teaching. I'm a teacher, or was before I retired. And every day I'd look at one of these cats and think, I wish I could change places with that cat. I wish I could lie there all day and send that cat out to do what I've got to do today. I knew there was something wrong with me. As I say, I really did. I'm one of those people that when I saw could be restored to sanity at my very first meeting, there was a sense of relief because I knew I was going mad. The way I behaved, drunk or sober, was not right. And I never shared with anyone what was actually going in my mind because I thought if I ever I let people know what I'm thinking, you know, I was definitely get locked up. So I was at a great advantage when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing that I knew I was insane. And I'd known that for some considerable time. But every day I'd get dressed up, go into school, do a day's teaching. I didn't like authority. The headmaster would try to counsel me occasionally. I know I can't swear today, but I turned to F off and mind his own business. And I'd say, who the hell do you think you are? And he'd say, John, I'm the head teacher. It's my job to counsel people. And I thought, I suffered with great paranoia. I thought he was trying to get me. I thought everyone was out to get me, to be quite honest. But I realised now that all he wanted to do was try and help me in some way. Everyone did. They all were so concerned about my drinking, and that was it initially, the drinking. Let me tell you what happened on January the 17th, 1986. I had no intention of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Obviously, I'm a teacher. I'm too bright for that sort of place, I thought. And I woke up again. My wife was not in the bed next to me. That was a fairly regular occurrence. I woke up and I couldn't remember what had happened the night before, and that had become a very regular occurrence. I knew I'd been to a union meeting. I was the shop steward of the union. Quite a few alcoholics involved there, in retrospect, looking at it. And I'd been to a union meeting. I'd come in on the Thursday night from school, angry, again, for whatever reason. I don't think I needed a reason by this stage. Very angry, angry with the head, angry with the job, angry with the government, angry with the religions, angry with everybody. I made my own booze, and that's a totally different story. The night I was 12-stepped, if you brought the garage door up, it was like looking at Aladdin's cave. The three walls were racked from floor to ceiling with wine racks. And everyone was filled with a homemade bottle of wine. I think it's 364 bottles of wine I had racked, all collecting dust, which I thought was rather grand. And upstairs in one of the bedrooms, there were over 30 one-gallon demijohns with wine in that had finished plopping away and waiting to be put into bottles. And there were five vats of 5 gallon filled with wine waiting to be put into the demijohns. Downstairs we'd had an extension built, ostensibly for the washing machines and stuff, a laundrette type place, but it had become my brewery. And down there I had 5 5-gallon barrels of beer under pressure waiting to be drunk, with a vat of 5 gallons waiting to be poured into the first barrel that emptied. You know, we've got a saying in the book, half measures availed us nothing. Half measures have never availed me nothing. You know, once I get interested in something, that is it. I used to try and get people round to drink with me. If I could get them really drunk, I always felt more comfortable. I felt I wasn't alone. So, you know, I came in from school that day on the Thursday, the 16th of January, and I was due to go to the union meeting. The idea was to raise the education system to the ground. and start all over again, my way. I was at war with, I think it was Margaret Thatcher and Sir Keith Joseph, who was the education minister at the time. But it wouldn't have mattered which government was in there. I just hated them. And I was in the mindset of wanting people dead. And it wouldn't have harmed, you know, my natural way of thinking was, let's get rid of those two in any form. I was in a really sick place, but not knowing it, but I justified it all. So what I did, I came in, I had two or three pints of homemade beer, opened a bottle of parsnip wine, which seemed to be the strongest, drank that, had another pint of beer, had my tea, and then went off to the AA meeting, to the union meeting. And on the way, I was picking up Ronnie Boyle, a friend of mine, a teaching colleague of mine, who also made his homemade booze. And he said, before we go, John, I've got some special drink I've just brewed. It's called carrot whiskey. Would you like to come and try it? I said, well, that sounds very entertaining. So I'd had all that other stuff, and I went in, and I drank some of this carrot whiskey. All I remember, it was burnt on the way down. I thought, this must be really good stuff. And eventually I got to the teacher's centre in Luton with Ronnie, and I'm on my way now. I'm really on my way now. I'm ready for a real fight now. And I get there, and I had a bottle of Newcastle Brown. That was my drink at the time. It was a strong strong beer, which seemed to do the trick fairly quickly. And I started on my second bottle of Newcastle Brown. That was about 8 o'clock, just before the union meeting's about to start. And I'm just filled up. I just feel so stuffed. So for some unknown reason, I never drank this stuff. I started drinking Southern Comfort. And that's all I remember around about 8 o'clock that night. I don't remember anything else at all. So I woke up the next morning. And I don't know about you guys, but early on when I was 16, 17, 18, in my early 20s, if someone said to me, what was your night like last night? I said, you know, I can't remember anything. It must have been a great night. When I couldn't remember it, what a great night that was. I can't remember a thing. But those days were gone. I woke up and I was frightened. That's the only way I can describe it. I would not have admitted it at that point, because I couldn't remember it. She wasn't there, and I thought, oh God, what have I done? And I'm going to pretend to be asleep until she comes in. That's what I'm going to do. And just see what sort of mood she's in. And then I'll go along with whatever mood she's in. I didn't have long to wait. The bedroom door slammed open, crashed against the wall, stomped across the wooden floor of the bedroom, open drawers, open wardrobe doors, slam wardrobe doors. I thought, that must have been really bad last night. So I sat up in bed and I said, that's it, I'm not drinking again. So I had an idea what was going wrong with me. And she just spat the words out, you and your drinking are all on your own. Off she went, off to work. And I got ready, I got in the car. And a common thing for me, driving into school, was a big lorry coming towards me, and I thought, I could finish it all now. I could really finish it all now. I could just drive in front of that lorry, I've had enough. I never, you know, I just didn't have the guts to do it, or the moment went. I got into work. I didn't have an argument with the head that day. I didn't have an argument with any of the other staff that day. And that night I went around to see my girlfriend. Funny what we pick up when, I don't know about you guys, as a practicing alcoholic, I was a loudmouth, foul-mouth atheist at that point. Anyone who believed in God or went to church or did spiritual, they were soft people. Why can't they just learn to manage their own lives? I had no sympathy or empathy with anyone, believe me. And this girlfriend of mine, she's a born-again Christian. We went away on naughty weekends together and stuff like that. And you know, part of the story is that, you know, she was asked at one point, you know, it's about some long-term relationship with John, and their answer to that was, there's no way I'm ever having any long-term relationship with him. He's crazy. I never know what he's going to do next. And I didn't. I was a reactor to life. I thought I was enjoying every moment. I went round there and I announced to her that I was not going to drink for a whole week. So I'd gone down in the morning, I'm not going to drink again. I think reality had set in. I said, I'm not going to drink for a week. And she said something really strange. So if you're not going to drink for a week, why bother starting again after that week? I thought, that's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And but I went home. And I got home. And around about 6:30, I got the Yellow Pages and looked up Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know where that idea came from. I've no idea where that idea came from. And my wife at the time, she said, "Who are you phoning?" I said, "I'm phoning Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I need a hand with this." And she said, "That's a bit drastic, isn't it?" Now, believe me, there had been some violence in our house, and not from my part. Anyone that was living with me during that period, I'd drive them crazy. A couple of examples. One, I was pissed on whiskey one Sunday lunchtime, and I was being particularly obnoxious, apparently, and I drove her to the point where she tried to put a carving knife into me. And that's what living with me would have done to anybody. We were coming out of a pub one night in Shropshire, where I used to live, and drunk. I always drove. And someone had the audacity to overtake me. Just took off to them like Stirling Moss. I suppose it'd be Lewis Hamilton nowadays, wouldn't it? And my wife sitting in the passenger seat, I mean, whatever speed we were doing, she was terrified. She was screaming, "Please stop, please stop." I just ignored her completely, obviously, because this man had dared to overtake me. How dare they? Don't they know who I think I am? You know, all that sort of stuff. And the only way she could stop me, she'd been spraying her hair with lacquer, and she got the lacquer tin and just smashed me in the face with the lacquer tin. And I had to stop. There was blood everywhere. And that's what I drove people to if they were living with me. So when she said, "That's a bit drastic, isn't it?" Even to this day, I think it's a drastic step for anyone to take. Alcoholics Anonymous, for people of our caliber, my word. But, you know, I said, "Yeah, it is a drastic step, but I'll see what they've got to say." So I phoned the number. It's a London number. And the lady on the other end didn't say, "This is Alcoholics Anonymous." She just related the number. So I had to say, "Is that Alcoholics Anonymous?" She said, "Yes, it is. Can I help you?" And at some point she said, do you think you have a problem with alcohol?" I said, "No, I don't. I just want to tone it down a bit." So in one way I'm denying it, in another way I'm admitting it. And we chatted, I don't remember an awful lot, but at some point she said, "Would you like someone to come round and see you?" Now, I don't know about you guys, but I developed this gift. And it's the gift of being able to lie without any thought process at all. You know, I'd get in late, very late at night, and my wife would say, "You know, why are you so late?" "Oh, the tyre burst. I had to change the tyre on the car, you know. You've been drinking." "No, I haven't. How dare you?" "Well, I can smell it." And then I get angry about the fact that she was accusing me of lying, not about drinking and me lying. But the thought process went something like this. You know, she said, "Would you like someone from AA to come round and see you?" I answered the question within 2 seconds. As I say, I was a reactor to life. But my thought process was, I phoned London. If anyone's going to come and see me, they're going to have to come from London. They're going to have to phone me. They're going to have to book an appointment, and that will probably be in 2 weeks' time. And now all this is going like this, and they'll probably phone to confirm the appointment. By then I'll be okay, which is the story of my life, really. And then I'll be able to cancel it and say, "No, thank you, I'm okay." So out of my mouth came, "Yeah, that's fine." All that thought had been going on. So I put the phone down round about 7:15, and just after 7:50, the phone went. This guy said, "Hi, I'm Simon. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous." And it was like yesterday. I said, "My God, that's quick." Because I was expecting 2 weeks. And he said, I believe that you've asked someone to come and see you. And and I'm the man, I'm the chosen one. I mean, he didn't use those words. And he said, "When would you like me to come round and see you?" And I thought, well, he's obviously in London if he's going to come and see me. And all this was going on in my mind. He's going to come and see me. He's going to come in a couple of weeks' time. He's going to phone me, confirm the appointment. By then, I'll be able to say, no, thanks, I don't need you anymore. I'm all right now. So out of my mouth came, anytime you like, Simon. Now it's 5 to 7 on this Friday night. And he said, how about 7:30 tonight? And I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned. I said, where on earth do you live? Now, I lived in a really nice village in Bedfordshire, Toddington, very pleasant place. He said, John, if you walk out of your front drive and turn left and go to the top of the road and turn right, I live in one of the houses up there on the left-hand side. And I can only say that I was impressed. You see, mine was a really nice house, but it was joined onto another one. It was a semi. Those houses up there were huge 5-bedroom detached houses. I've got a nice little go-fast Astra in the drive. They've got 3 really posh cars. I mean, I was so impressed. And, yeah, that's fine, okay. So I put the phone down. Now, my wife has been listening to this, and she said, what have you done? I said, I've got this man from Alcoholics Anonymous coming round at 7:30. I said, oh, my God, we don't want any of those sort of people round here. What have you done? Don't you know what you've done? And I thought, yeah. So I said, it's okay, I'll get rid of him really quickly. It's okay. Now, it's January, the middle of January. It's pouring down with rain outside. It's very dark. The wind is blowing a gale. And I'm looking out of the window, waiting for the little white van to arrive with AA on the side of it. And I passed exams to get to this level of thinking, believe me. And I thought, oh God, what will the neighbours say? Thinking that the neighbours are looking out at my house at this time of the winter. And anyway, I must have just... come away, I looked away and the doorbell went. I felt as though he must have been hiding behind a wall or something and jumped out as soon as I stopped looking out of the window. And I opened the door and there he stood, Simon, from Alcoholics Anonymous. And from the moment I saw him, I just liked him. He got this easygoing smile. He was wearing a leather jacket, a T-shirt with a sweatshirt over it, a pair of jeans and a pair of white trainers. I think it's probably the AA uniform of the time. I don't know. But I liked him. From the moment I saw him, he got this easy smile. And he came in and sat down, and my wife sat down in the same room. And one of the questions he asked me was, do you find that you have a drink before you go to the pub? She just jumped straight in. She said, he always does that. I said, hold on a second. And I wasn't annoyed with her, the fact that she'd answered the question. It puzzled me how she'd got to the answer so quickly. And I thought, now let me see, yesterday I went to that union meeting, yeah, I had a few drinks before, Wednesday, yeah, I went up to the Sound Pigs, yeah, I did have a few drinks before, but she just beat me to it, and I said, hold on a second, you know, I get to the pub, and I'm in a round of with a few people, and I always get the first round, because I'm the thirstiest. And I drink, my pint, and they're still standing there talking about the kids and the weather and stuff, and they're about an inch down their pint glass, and they invariably say, John, you know, don't get so angry. Go and get yourself another drink, and when you've got yourself a drink, you know, we'll join in with the next round. So I always found that it was much better for me if I had a few drinks before I got to the pub, and then I could behave in a semi-appropriate way. I didn't have to rush them. I could listen to the conversation and I could join in with the conversation. And then he said, do you find you have a few drinks before you go to parties? She just jumped straight in, said, we don't get invited to those anymore. He said, he always ends up drinking the house whiskey, always. And whiskey is not what he should be drinking. Whiskey makes him very, very angry and he gets into rows with people. And it's always him and the host, and the hostess usually has a row and we get kicked out. But yes, he does drink when we used to go to parties. And I said, well, hold on, you stand on the doorstep and you ring the doorbell, you've got to stand and talk about and how's the weather, and that's very nice, and the kids, and how's the job, and that's all very nice. And usually there's a hallway and a golden light coming out of the kitchen at the end, and that's where I want to be, because that's where the booze is. So I found it better if I had a few drinks before getting to the party. And I could stand on the doorstep. And I could, again, be semi-appropriate and join in a bit of conversation. Oh, and by the way, John, the drinks are down there in the kitchen. Well, thank you very much indeed. And off I go, and that's where I'd end up. But I liked him. I just liked him. He He mentioned coming to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like every newcomer I've ever spoken to in the 30 years I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I came out with that immortal question, where is it? He said, John, it's in Houghton Regis. I said, I can't possibly go to Houghton Regis. I teach in Houghton Regis. I know far too many people in Houghton Regis. He said, John, in the AA meeting, they're all alcoholics. I said, I'm not going. So I'm going to another one on Wednesday. And again, I said, where is it? I said, he said, Leighton Buzzard, a Mr. Big film star that I thought I was. I said, well, I don't know too many people in Leighton Buzzard. That should be all right. So we arranged to go to that meeting on the Wednesday night. But what he did, he left me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he did a real neat trick. He said, I'm going to leave you this book. It didn't have a cover on like mine, Scott, now. It's the blue book with the words Alcoholics Anonymous on the front of it, the big blue cover. And he said, John, that is my book. If you change your mind about the meeting on Wednesday, I will come back to get my book. That's a neat trick. I always use that now. Gives a second bite at people. He was a great bloke, Simon. Anyway, I started to read the book after he'd gone. I hadn't had a drink all day, and I'm shaking a bit after the night before, and what have I done? And I start to read the book. Now, you'll notice I identify myself as one who has recovered from alcoholism. There are two R words in Alcoholics Anonymous which sometimes aren't too popular. One is that word, recovered, and the other one is relationships. Well, my relationship is fine. I'm married. I've been married for nearly 27 years now. But I opened the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that first night, and I couldn't believe what it said. It said, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. I thought, I didn't know you could do that. Then I started to read, you know, we are a fellowship of men and women, and I just liked the way it was written. I got into the doctor's opinion. I liked that thing about the allergy, being ill and not being bad, because I knew I was bad. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a thief, a cheat, a liar, an adulterer, with teaching qualifications, obviously, and a start raving mad alcoholic, thinking that I was going insane. And the last thing I ever thought I would ever do was not drink again. That's Friday. I've got a few days. Next Friday, I am drinking. I am going to drink next Friday. And I start to read the book, and it got into, you know, various chapters. And I just started to read, and I didn't miss a word out. I read every word. Now, I wasn't a great reader, but I read Bill's story. Now I know, looking back, that really hooked me. An incredible story. It surmises the whole of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in it. And then at some point I got to We Agnostics. And as an atheist, I thought, well, where am I going to fit in with this? Now, people have told me for years and years, you're not going to go to heaven. You're too bad. And I've given up on the idea. I thought, I don't want to be with people like you anyway. They weren't attractive for me, these people who said, these sickly, smiley people who said, you're not going to go to heaven. I thought, well, you're going. I don't want to spend eternity with you guys. You know, I just don't. I wouldn't fit in there. And I just isolated myself away from all that stuff. And in here, it said, and the fundamental idea of God can be found deep down within every man, woman and child. And I actually, at that moment in time, thought, that includes me. Now, put this into perspective. I've read the book, all every page, every word. And then it's also in that chapter, it said, perhaps we'd looked at the ugliness of some of the trees and missed the beauty of the forest. And in context, as I was reading, I thought, that's me. I always do that. Look at that effing war in Northern Ireland. If there was a God, that wouldn't happen. Look at effing famine in Africa. If there was a God, that wouldn't happen. Look at that there. If there was a God, that wouldn't happen. It was always like that for me. And it just described me to a T. So I moved into chapter 5. And as I say, I've read every word, every page. I'll get to the second page of chapter 5, right at the very top. And it said, there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And at that moment in time, I felt this lovely warm feeling come down round about me, and I didn't feel alone anymore. And I cannot explain that. Now I moved over onto the third page of chapter 5, and two-thirds of the way down it says, and being convinced, we're at step 3. I remember it like it was yesterday. And I thought, it's a trick book. Being convinced. To get to exam 3, I've had to pass exam 1, exam 2, bingo, exam 3. Test 1, test 2, bingo, test 3. Being convinced. Obviously, they're short of people. They want to fill the seats up in their meetings. People of my calibre, I thought. You know, it's a trick book. And I don't remember anything else until the man came to pick me up on the Wednesday night, Simon. And he said, I said, I'll go in my car. I thought, I'm not going to hang around in this meeting for too long. He said, no, John, we don't do it like that. You come in my car. At any point, it's like he was reading my mind. At any point you want to leave, just let me know and I will bring you away from the meeting. And I got into the car to that very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there are three major reasons I could not possibly be an alcoholic. One, I'm obviously too rich to be an alcoholic. I've got a couple of hundred quid in the bank. Two, I'm obviously too bright to be an alcoholic. I've passed all these exams. But three, I think the major reason was I'm far too young to be an alcoholic. I'm only 38 years old. Now, I always share that bit. And I was doing this, a chair in London, a few months ago, and this chap shared back. He said, John, I got to AA when I was 64 years old, and on the way to my very first meeting, I thought, I'm too young to be an alcoholic. Incredible, is it? It's all in the mind. So there I am, I'm going to this meeting I don't want to go to. It's Wednesday, I haven't had a drink Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. You can tell I'm a maths teacher, can't you? 6 days without a drink. I've got tomorrow to go. I am drinking on Friday. I've had a spiritual experience from reading the book. I like the book. In there it says, we think few to whom this book will appeal will be able to stay sober anything like a year. I've taken it all on board. I now know that. But I'm drinking on Friday. I've got a day to go. And I walked through the door of my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I walked into a brand new life. And that's thanks to you. You might not have been around that length of time. We might not have ever met each other before today. But that's thanks to you. You've made an incredible impression on my life. Incredible. And I've never drank in all those years. And that was not my intention. I sat in that meeting one night. I know we say that swear words aren't very attractive, but I heard a man using the F word every fourth or fifth word and talking about having a loving God in his life. I thought, oh my God, I didn't know you could swear like that and still have a God in your life. And that night, if everyone had thrown the keys into the middle of the room, which I was hoping they would do, I would have taken anyone's key except mine. That's the impression you had on me that very first night. And it's just been an incredible journey. Incredible journey. As I say, we say there are no lectures to be endured. That isn't true. Well, I got on the wagon. I thought I was doing the right way. I found God. I went from being a foul-mouthed, loud-mouthed atheist 1 week. I was in a Pentecostal church in Luton doing all this the following week. We are extremists, aren't we? I loved it. I had a Catholic sponsor at the time. I didn't know anything about religion. I was trying to drag him. I said, Frank, you've got to come. You've got to come to this Pentecostal church. It's just like AA. People give their testimony. You put hands in the air and we have a great time. And he didn't knock me down ever. He just said, John, perhaps next week. Catholic ain't going to go to a Pentecostal church. And I got so into it that after the services, we're only talking a few weeks. We're not talking years. Only a few weeks. They used to go. The pastors used to have tea and biscuits after the service. And I went round. One of the pastors just said, "Well, I haven't seen you around. You've been coming for a couple of weeks. You know what?" I said, "Oh, I'm John. So I'm an alcoholic. I found out I'm an alcoholic. I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I found God, and I was an atheist for years and years and years. And I know I'm on a pink cloud, and I'm going to come off the pink cloud because all the alcoholics tell me I'm going to come off the pink cloud." And he said, "John, if you've really found God, you need never come off that pink cloud. And then they started to talk about you got to do it through Jesus or you're going to burn in hell. They probably didn't say those words, but I thought, hold on a second. My friends in AA, they're not of that type. And I know they're going to be okay. You are the biggest example for me. And so I stopped that. It was a nice experience. I just got into AA. And the journey started. I joined a group in the first group I went to was in Leighton Buzzard. It was a 12 by 12 group, 12 steps and 12 tradition group. And each week we do one step, and after 12 we do a tradition. And it had a real effect on me, a major effect. And the chap who, Simon in fact, became my sponsor. And he took me through the steps using the 12 by 12 and it had a real effect on me. I felt as I belonged. I felt I was on the road, on a different road, and I felt better. I didn't do an awful lot then. I went to lots of meetings. I left my wife after 18 months and ran off into the sunset with a born-again Christian girlfriend who's with me today. We've been married now. When she said she'd never have any long-term relationship with me, this coming August, we've been married for 27 years, and we've been together for 29 years, and that's thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the journey's just started, and you know, unfortunately, I'm one of those types of people who has to be right, it seems to me, in those early years. And from learning, I became an expert again. And I joined a group of people, the name of that group, a collective group of people was Intergroup. And we were like the policemen of the local AA meetings. They're not doing it right, and they shouldn't do that, and how do they do that, and why do they do that? And we thought we were doing the right thing. And I know all people aren't like that, but try to explain to people like me that we're like an inverted triangle. Intergroup's up here somewhere. Meridian actually is the fellowships that's up there, and then all the rest. But not at that time, 2 years, 3 years. And, you know, I don't forget, I was the public information guy, and we spoke to 3,000 school kids in 1 year. We take 30 members of Alcoholics Anonymous into a school. We'd show them, if you haven't seen the Young People's DVD, it's an incredible thing, about 14 minutes long. We'd show that to 300 school kids on different TVs. You could have heard a pin drop. And then we'd break up into groups of about 12, 14, and two members of AA would go to the groups. And we'd get invited back time after time after time. So, you know, all those years weren't bad, but I was getting sicker again. I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't grasping and enlarging my spiritual life. What I was doing, I was a member of AA. And I love talking. You know, I'm a good talker. I'm great. You know, I teach kids. I have to learn how to talk good, otherwise they won't take any notice. And I became a know-it-all. That's what happened to me. And I became as critical around about 4 or 5 years sober and judgmental as I was before getting to Alcoholics Anonymous. Without a drink, I'm now pointing the finger at members of AA, saying that they're wrong, you're wrong, that group's wrong. And I was surrounded by a group of people, perhaps just as sick as me. You know, some people, long-term sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. For example, I go and see my sponsor at the time, and he said, well, where'd you go last night? And I tell him the name of a group that I went to. He said, what do you think? I said, I didn't like it. It was crap, crap, crap. He said, yeah, they're all sick there, John, don't go there. So I didn't go. So I'd go to another meeting. And he'd say, what was that meeting like? I said, oh, I didn't like it. He said, oh, they're all sick there. You don't want to go to that meeting. They're all sick. Was so-and-so there? I said, yeah, he was. He said, oh, he's a sick man, you don't know. Oh, okay, all right. So I began to judge people. You know, if you're new, you may be coming out with those terms of we don't ever get judged and we don't get criticised. You know, that isn't true. We're the kings of judging. I'm an international gymnastics judge. I've got qualifications to judge people, for God's sake. You know, but we're a very, you know, I was a very sick person. Very, very sick around about 5 years. And the trouble with falling out with a meeting in my mind and not telling them and not going to it, I was having to drive a 25-mile radius to get to a meeting I hadn't fallen out with yet. And then this sponsor said to me one day, you know, Billy, for example, what do you think of him? I said, he's a really nice chap. He said, I can't trust you anymore. You think everybody's nice. Well, that wasn't true, but I thought, hold on. And I got so uncomfortable. This lady at school, the head of maths, I thought she was a bitch, to be quite honest. And I told him I was having all this trouble. He said, well, John, if you go into school and look at her, when you're in the school, and you'll probably see that she's got all the character traits that you've got inside you. So I went into school and I sat and looked at this woman. I thought, my God, she's just like me. He's right. She's just like me. And it gave me a lot of relief. But 3 days later, I hate this bitch again. And it didn't work. And then this guy, you know, there's a story in the back of the big book that talks about resentments. And it says something like, if you don't like someone, you're resentful, pray that they get everything that you've ever wanted or something for 2 weeks, and that resentment will go away. Well, I did that with this woman, and that lasted for about a day and a half, and I hated that bitch after a day and a half. So that didn't work for me. And one day, this sponsor, long-term sober member of AA, said, well, I knew a man who was 20 years sober. When you get these stories, they're always 20 years sober, or 30 years sober. And he was wearing a pair of shoes one day, and he was doing up his shoelaces, and he was tying his shoelaces, and the shoelace snapped. And he went into a fit of rage, and he went off, and it drove him back to drink. And he pointed down at his shoes. And I noticed he's wearing slip-ons. Absolutely true. And I sat there thinking, one day I want to wear lace-up shoes. So I thought, this, yeah, perhaps this man hasn't really got what I need. I wouldn't have put it into those words, to be quite honest. I wouldn't. But I became so uncomfortable with me. I got to a place with me that I didn't want to feel like this anymore. I didn't want to fall out with people. I didn't want to judge and criticise people. I didn't want to point the finger at people. I didn't want to go to groups and be angry with them inside. But I thought, that's it. Perhaps the pink cloud thing has just happened and that's it. And now I've come off the pink cloud. And perhaps my life's just going to be like this from now on. 5.5 years sober. And I was on the way to a convention with Sue in Jersey. And there's a beautiful man, my sponsor now, a man called Bob from Letchworth. Some of you may know him. He celebrated 36 years on Thursday. Lovely man. Beautiful man. And I knew him from when I first started in AA. And I always thought he was just like on God's right-hand side. He's just such a nice man. We're on the plane going to Jersey with his wife and my wife. And he said to me, how are things going? And I told him. I said, well, I go to meetings, I'm criticising people, and he's sitting there. And he said, yes, I was like that last year, John. I said, Bob, you didn't hear me. I said, and I said, and he said, yeah, I was like that last year. And I caught on to the word was. I said, what do you mean you were? You're not like that now? He said, no, John, I met a man. And the first words out of my mouth were, could I meet this man? I didn't know who the man was. I didn't know what he was going to do, anything about it. He said, I'll see what I can do. But it sorted me out. He said, I've changed. My wife knows that I've changed. We arranged to meet the man. We were living up near Northampton. This guy lived in Chelmsford, American. And I got down there. I recognised him from an AA convention I'd been to years and years before. And I tried to find him. I knew, just listening to him when he was on the podium, that he had something special. He was different. And we got down there and he said, well, what's your story? And I told him. I said, well, took a deep breath. I'm a very important member of Intergroup, don't you know? I'm the public information man. I speak to 33,000 people. I started a new group at Toddington. And I went on and on and on. And at the end of it, he said, we may have trouble with you. What do you mean? He said, you think you know too much. And as soon as he said it, I knew. I did. And I'm sitting in front with this man, and I thought, he knows more than me. I hadn't met anyone until that moment in time who I thought knew more than me. They might well have done, but I didn't think they did. But this man did. He said, well, what do you want? I said, well, I think I'd like to be a better husband to my wife. He said, there's no problem with that. He said, while we're about it, we'll get rid of that dark cloud that's hanging over your head. And I thought, how did he know about that? Because there was a dark cloud always hanging over my head. He said, what we're going to do, John, we're going to use this book. And immediately I was disappointed. I thought, oh, I know all about that book. I haven't read it for 5 years, but I knew all about that book. Oh, I thought it was going to be something special. And he said, what we're going to do, John, is we're going to follow the precise, specific, clear-cut directions from this book. I said, what are you talking about? Look, my information up until that point was, oh, the program of recovery, a bit like a recipe. You know, you can put a bit of salt in, a bit of chili in, a bit of this in. You can do it to taste. You don't have to follow instructions. Just any recipe, do it. My wife's a food teacher. She does not allow me to do any cooking at home because that's what I do. And that's what I was doing with my sobriety. People meant well. So we started on a little thing with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, John, if you follow the precise, specific, clear-cut directions of the big book. And they're words from the book. I didn't know that. I said, oh, wait till I tell the people in Bedfordshire about precise, clear-cut. He said, John, don't do that. They really don't do that. If they wanted to do that, they would be here. But I would not do that. And that's why I discovered the word recovered again. He said, John, I said, I'm going to tell them. He said, John, don't tell them. Please do not. Let everyone else run their own lives and you just run your life. And what's happened, I suppose, for the first time ever from about 24 years ago, I went through the program from the big book, following the instructions and continue to do so. And it's changed my whole life. And for the first time ever from that moment, I was able to give other people the dignity to be who they are. None of my business what anyone else does in Alcoholics Anonymous. None of my business how my wife behaves, how my neighbours behave. None of my business. Now for me to be saying that, that is a miracle. All I have to do is grasp and develop a manner of living. All I have to do is think about where have I been wrong today? Who do I owe an apology to? And the great thing for me, I discovered when these things occur. That's what the book says. Until I met this man, I was told, oh, well, now you've done the steps, you shouldn't feel like that, and you shouldn't be angry, you shouldn't be frightened. So I just stopped sharing. I didn't tell people I was frightened or angry, because it's wrong. But I went through this and I discovered when these things crop up. And I sponsor a lot of people. And I opened a big book up to them. I said, this is what it says. When we get angry, when we, and notice I always use the word we, me included. It's not that I'm now never going to get angry, never going to get frightened. So it's a big relief for me. And from that day, I think it had as big a thing in my life as it did when I walked into that very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It changed my life. And one of the things I know I must do, I must continue to do that. Alcoholics of my type. I meet alcoholics, I meet heavy drinkers. I meet all sorts of people in AA. They really don't need to do that. They do other things. And I found that I've tried other things and it's no good for me. I have to do the stuff in here. I've just got to. If I don't, I revert back to type. After all these years, I revert back to you're wrong again. Those meetings are wrong again. And the first person who notices it is my wife, the lady that I live with. The second people that notice it, the people I meet on the road as I pull out of my drive. And then the people in AA start to notice, and the people at the golf club start to notice. So I'd like to thank Thomas for inviting me. I'd like to thank you for listening. And I've just got to thank you for being you. Not only, I don't want to do this journey of life by myself. I don't think I could do it by myself. And I take you for granted a lot. I get to a lot of meetings. Malcolm, who I'm with today, we've been friends for 29, nearly 30 years. Albert, who some of you may know, he came here last year. Malcolm and Albert are very similar. They spent time in, I'm going to let some of your story out, Mal. Spent time in borstals and detention centres and prisons. They hated teachers. Believe me, they did not like teachers. And people like them, who I came across when I was teaching, I hated them. And Malcolm and Albert are perhaps my two closest friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. We love each other. We just love each other. We are definitely people who normally wouldn't meet. So I gather it's an hour.
Yeah.
It's 11 o'clock, and I'd just like to thank you all for listening. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, John, for sharing. I can identify with quite a bit of your story, you know. I came to AA and listened to, you know, the people, and they spoke about how many years they'd been drinking, 20, 30, 40 years of drinking, and I thought, I've been robbed. You know, I'd only done 15, and I was 29. And I thought, you know, then I listened to them sharing about, you know, their drinking, and I thought, I'll drink more than you for my breakfast, but I've not got your problems. And I came in March 1975, and I was drunk at every meeting until I was locked away. Mm-hmm. And then I came back after being locked in the mental institution, and then they sent me to what they called a clinic, which was nothing like the clinics now. I didn't drink, but on fear. But I planned a drink on Christmas Eve, 75, and my planning went all wrong. I ended up in an AA meeting. And same people, it was in the room over there. And when I got home, my wife said to me, "Well, how are you?" And I said, "I feel different. But I haven't promised I'm not going to drink." But I became willing to go any length. And that's what I've done. And everything I've learned in life has come through this fellowship. Mm-hmm. You know, how to love, you know. I went into a few years. In AA, everyone has a name, don't they? This lady was Tokyo Jean. And I said to Tokyo Jean, "I love everyone in the meeting, but I do not like me." And she said, "Well, you love no one, Mick, because you first got to love yourself." And to learn to love me. And my old sponsor, she used to say, "Always look for the good in the person, because there's never anybody born that hasn't got good in them." And I said, "Well, what do you do if you can't see the good in anyone?" She said, "Well, you don't look." You know, because I always looked for bad in the person, because that's how I was. We had a man named Tommy G, and I said to him, "Tommy, I'm chasing this program. I'm getting nowhere." And he said, "Mick, you've got to sit down, relax, and let it flow over you." He said, "And give it time." And we have plenty of time. I was very privileged that my wife was an Al-Anon. And I had the privilege of having Alateen in our family as well. And, you know, our family grew like that. We drifted. We come back together. And we were going up and down. But we were talking. I remember when my wife was in Al-Anon before I got sober. And on one occasion, I slashed my wrist because we were arguing about booze. And I slashed my wrist. And I said to her, "Look what you made me do." And she took me to the hospital. On the next time, she said, "You cut them, you get there." You know, the difference between, you know, pre-Al-Anon and Al-Anon. You know, yeah, they told her if I was drunk and I had a job to get through the door, don't shout and scream at him, make him a cup of tea. And she said, "Make him a cup of tea, I'll throw the effing tea at him." You know, But, you know, we had nearly 40 years together in sobriety. And she wrote me a letter before she died. And, you know, and it was beautiful. Mm. It was a beautiful letter. And how she put it was, the dark clouds, when I first met you, she said, and, you know, everything was rosy. But after a little while, the dark clouds were gathering. And then suddenly it descended on us. But we rode the storm together. And now the sun shines in our life. And she says, I know I am safe with you now, Mick. And, you know, and I know that you will look after me. And, you know, I read that often and I think, mm-hmm. What a woman. And Al-Anon, what a woman. And this fellowship has taught me how to live my life through the pain, to put every negative into a positive. And that's what I do today. I love this fellowship. And thank you very much for sharing. Thank you, John.
Privilege, a real privilege.